This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. On November 22, 1963, news anchor Walter Cronkite made this tragic and historic announcement.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
In the last 50 years, Kennedy's life and presidency has been dissected, analyzed, lionized, criticized, and written about in an estimated 44,000 books. Our guest is presidential historian Robert Dalek, whose new book, Camelot's Court, explores Kennedy's relationship with his advisors, his inner circle, his, quote, ministry of talent. They were a kind of team of rivals whose bad advice made Kennedy wary of experts. The focus was on the Cold War and foreign policy, with domestic policy taking a back seat. Robert Dalek is the author of a number of books, including another book about John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. And Robert Dalek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
You know, listening to that, and you and I are old enough to remember that fateful day, and we kept in Walter Cronkite's long pause there because when you hear his crack in his voice, you hear the sort of crack in that sort of wall of the newscaster.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Marty, I don't think the country has gotten over that killing yet. In fact, what I find so striking about it is that in 1901, William McKinley, who was a popular president, a Republican who had been elected to a second term, he was assassinated. 50 years after his death, hardly anybody remembered who he was, but not with Kennedy. Part of it, of course, is television and the fact that the media has so captured his image. But there's a lot more to this than just the television. And he has a phenomenal hold on the world's imagination.
Well, is it because he was attractive? He had an attractive family. He was young. There was this sort of Camelot patina over his administration and his family?
It's all that. I think also it's that the Kennedys have become an American dynasty. It's not the Roosevelts. It's not the Bushes. It's the Kennedys. And what makes them so attractive to people in this country, I think, is on the one hand, they are the fulfillment of the American dream. The Irish Catholics from Boston, who Joe Kennedy made a fortune, became so famous, so wealth and fame attached to them. But at the same time, they're star-crossed. So much tragedy. The oldest brother killed in World War II. The oldest sister killed in a plane crash in 1948. The president assassinated. His brother Robert running for president in 1968. He was assassinated. John Kennedy's son, John Jr., killed in a plane crash, senseless plane crash off of Cape Cod, and Jacqueline Kennedy dying in her early 60s of cancer. Ted Kennedy, the horrors of Chappaquiddick, and the young woman who dies in that accident. So it's just one thing after another. But I think the country identifies, on the one hand, with their phenomenal success, but also with the tragedy, because people have things that they suffer through in this life, and so they have these dual reasons for being drawn to the whole family. But Kennedy himself, I think, is enormously appealing because the image of him, you're quite right, there is the Camelot aura that surrounds him, but it's more than that. It's the fact that people are not enamored of the successors. Johnson with Vietnam, Nixon with Watergate, Ford's truncated presidency, Jimmy Carter's failed presidency, the two Bushes, the second Bush under a cloud leaving because of Katrina and the Iraq War and the economic downturn. And so there was a poll, a Gallup poll, a few years ago, asking Americans to assess the last nine presidents from Kennedy to George W. Kennedy had an 85% approval rating. The only one close to him was Reagan with 74%. And so people want hope. They want a better day. And they think of Kennedy as someone who could have done that.
But could have.
Of course. We don't know, and they don't know. But they invest in him, in a sense. He's tabula rasa.
Well, a kind of a projective test, because I've read people who say, well, Kennedy was a peacenik. No, Kennedy was a warmonger. No, Kennedy was a liberal. No, he was he was a conservative.
And it
seems that people want to project onto him their perhaps fantasies about who they think he was.
He's become a mythological figure, and you're exactly right. People project onto him. He was a compulsive womanizer, which he was. Does it bring him down? No. He covered up his health problems, which I revealed in that first book.
I remember that, yes.
In that first book. But it doesn't bring him down, and so there's enough there that people attach to him and have this regard for him, this affection, one might say.
Well, in fact, this notion that 85% of the public gives him very high marks for his presidency, that became the kind of genesis for this new book, which is looking at his cabinet and how did they serve him, or did they serve him well?
Yes. Well, it's a very mixed story. He was quite inexperienced. And also, I love the anecdote that after he was elected, Robert Kennedy said to Arthur Schlesinger, who had written a book during the campaign about Kennedy and Nixon, "Does it matter?" And Robert Kennedy said to Schlesinger, "Arthur, how would you like to be an ambassador?" And Schlesinger said, "No, Bobby, if I do anything, I'd like to go to the White House." A few days later, he sees the president-elect, and Kennedy said to him, "So, Arthur, I hear you're coming to the White House." And Schlesinger said, "I am. What will I do there?" And Kennedy said, "I don't know, Arthur. I don't even know what I'll be doing there, but you can bet we'll both be busy more than 8 hours a day." Now, it was, a true word said in jest. They campaign. They talk up all sorts of things, but do they really know what they're going to do when they get there? And he was honest about it with Schlesinger. And so he was very reliant at first on his advisors, and in some ways the turning point was the April 1961 failure at the Bay of Pigs. That was a disaster. And afterwards he walked around saying, "How could I have been so stupid, you see?" And he didn't trust them that much anymore. He saw de Gaulle in France at the end of May, and de Gaulle said to him, "Surround yourself with the best and the brightest," not using that term, but
yes,
that was essentially it,
yes,
"and listen to them, hear what they have to say, but at the end of the day, you must make up your own mind." And Kennedy remembered what Harry Truman said, "The buck stops here," and so he was the responsible authority.
Well, you describe, and I'm sure it's true for every president, and it was certainly true for Kennedy, which is that transition from a grueling campaign, and here you are, you win the office, you become the president of the United States, and this kind of, what are we going to do now?
Right.
And everyone is exhausted on top of that.
Exactly. And, he kind of withdrew instantly after the campaign, and he complained to his father and said, "This one wants that, that one wants this," and joked with him and said, "Listen, Jack, they haven't counted all the ballots yet in Cook County. If you don't want to take the office, you don't have to do it," you see.
Was a ruthlessness in this family, was there not?
Was there ever, yes.
But I'm assuming every president, picks a cabinet with the idea that they will give the best advice, or this will be my sounding board.
Right.
Was that true for Kennedy?
Yeah, he picked people. It was partly the consequence of the very close election. He only won by 118,000 votes, and he was concerned to create a kind of bipartisan administration, a national government, if you will. And so he keeps J. Edgar Hoover on as head of the FBI, another conservative, Alan Dulles, as the director of the CIA, and he appoints Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who was a moderate Republican. He didn't know him, never met him, but had a fabulous reputation as the president of the Ford Motor Company and a brilliant young administrative director.
But no Pentagon background
experience. No, none at all. And McNamara said to him, I don't know anything about administering the Defense Department. Kennedy said, I don't know anything about running the presidency, he said, but, you know, we'll both do it. And then, of course, he appointed Dean Rusk, who was a very passive sort of a character, and that's what Kennedy wanted. Of course, he wanted to control foreign affairs. Mm. He had the people surrounding him. The Secretary of the Treasury was Eisenhower's Treasury Secretary, C. Douglas Dillon. He didn't know him. The only one he really knew was, of course, his brother, sure, Robert, who he made attorney general. And somebody said to him, you know, you're going to get yourself into political difficulties with this kind of nepotism. He said, look, I need someone I can put my feet up with and talk to candidly. And that's the role that Bobby played. More than that, I have a chapter in the book called the Robert Kennedy Advisor in Chief. He didn't have a chief of staff, Kennedy, but Bobby Kennedy was essentially the chief of staff.
And he also sounds like he played the role of the enforcer on top of that.
Without question.
I mean, he was more willing to be direct and overt,
right,
about,
absolutely,
throwing his weight around.
And you know, Marty, we will never have the many, many conversations I'm convinced they had behind closed doors that were not recorded, that were not put down on paper. And people would say, they'd come into a meeting with Bobby and the president and several other people, cabinet officers, whoever might have been CIA, defense, Pentagon officials. And Bobby would drop the dime on somebody or other. And Jack would sit there with a slight smile on his face. And the supposition was, they knew what was going to be said. And the president wouldn't say it. He didn't want to come down on one side or the other. But Bobby was sort of reflecting what he was thinking.
The kind of good cop, bad cop approach to foreign policy,
right,
in many instances. And we're almost up on a break here, but it sounds like Bobby Kennedy's experience in Congress sort of prepared him for being the enforcer.
Yeah, well, but Bobby's temperament was more like his father, Joe's. And he was a tough guy, and he played hardball, and he thought and understood that politics was hardball. Of course, he and Lyndon Johnson were at each other's throats, and Johnson is vice president, and Bobby is attorney general, and then, oh, goodness, they were really at it.
Well, no wonder there have been 44,000 books written about the Kennedys, the Kennedy White House, the Kennedy family. Our guest is Robert Dalek, a presidential historian, and he has a new book. It's called Camelot's Court, and it's subtitled Inside the Kennedy White House. And about 10 years ago, he wrote another book about John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Any questions or comments that you might have about Kennedy and his advisors and how you view his presidency and his life, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. FoxChase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. FoxChase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
The Y12K is back Saturday, November 9th, a day of outdoor fun and fitness for all ages. Test your limits with the 12K Road Race. Dress as your favorite Mr. Rogers character or Fred himself for the Fred 5K. There's the laid-back 3K walk run, perfect for families. And as always, PBS Kids characters and fun games at the Y Kids Family Fit Zone. The Y12K, supporting WHYY. Learn more and sign up at whyy.org/Y12K.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, have suburbs lost their cachet with millennials?
All evidence shows that they really want to be close to where the action is, and that can be in a kind of urban burb, but they want to be somewhere where they can walk to things, where they can be on their devices and not being behind the wheel of a car for, you know, half hour, hours at a time.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Robert Dalek about his new book called Camelot's Court. And it's about JFK's relationship with his advisors as they dealt with the Bay of Pigs disaster, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the growing conflict in Vietnam. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I think fiasco or disasters is a good description of the Bay of Pigs. This started early on in Kennedy's presidency.
Yeah, when he came into office, he was under the gun to find some way to topple that Castro regime in Cuba. Now, there was a plan that the Eisenhower administration had already put into place. They were training these Cuban exiles in Guatemala in preparation for a potential invasion. And Kennedy was skeptical about all this for a couple of reasons. One was he had put forward the Alliance for Progress, and the idea was sort of drawn from Franklin Roosevelt's notion of the good neighbor. Look, they are very suspicious of us in Latin America, with good reason, that we are the Yankee imperialists, and we want to reestablish good relations with them, and we want them to enjoy a degree of prosperity and progress, because otherwise they are a proving ground for communism. And Castro has gotten in there, and he's a subversive force in the hemisphere. So we need to get him out, but we don't want to just do it as gunboat diplomacy. Let's do this in a way that advances these Latin American countries and ends some of the poverty in those countries. So Kennedy is very skeptical of this. In fact, he moves the invasion from one place in Cuba to the Bay of Pigs because it will be less overt as to America's role. Now, they know. Nobody's going to think this could have happened.
It's secret, right?
That's right. It's an open secret. But he wants to keep America's role as muted as possible. And he tells the exiles in a meeting with them, the leadership, he tells them, American forces will not come in to rescue you if you falter. And they say, fine, we'll go ahead. And the CIA and the military tell Kennedy, there's going to be an uprising. Castro is unpopular. He's a communist. And they don't like this in Cuba. And there'll be an uprising. Now, I spoke to a journalist who was a friend of mine who was in Havana at the time of the Bay of Pigs. And he said to me, Bob, he said, any high school student in Havana could have told you that there would be no uprising. Castro was popular, and this was misleading because Kennedy didn't understand this until later. Also, what he was not told by the CIA, they had issued a memo which said that without American military intervention, the likelihood of this invasion succeeding was very, very small.
Wow. So
but they didn't tell Kennedy that. And so the assumption Kennedy understood later was that I'm a new president, I can't fail, and if this invasion is stuttering, I'm going to have to send in American troops. I'll have to. And, of course, he did give one order to some planes coming off an aircraft carrier to participate toward the end when the invasion was falling apart. And the four guys were killed. American aviators were killed in that exercise, and they were told, if you're shot down and captured, you deny that you're part of the American military.
Well, he was, as you write about, just absolutely furious about this failed, disastrous operation.
Oh yeah, and you know, here he is at the start of his presidency. His inaugural address had given the country hope, a sense of a new day. The torch had been passed to a new generation, and there's an excitement about his. And he's the youngest man ever elected to the presidency at the age of 43. And what happens? A disaster, and Khrushchev won this, you see, and Kennedy understands this. Mm-hmm. Khrushchev is going to see me as an easy mark now. And so it's a real setback for them.
And this is a quote from the president about the CIA and the military's poor judgment. Those sons of bitches with all the fruit salad just sitting there nodding, saying it would work.
Yeah. He just, you know, one of the things that is central to this book, and I think in many ways it's the freshest thing in there, was the extent to which Kennedy was locked in conflict with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I published an excerpt in The Atlantic called JFK versus the Joint Chiefs, and he battled with them particularly over nuclear weapons. He was determined not to get into some kind of conflict that would require the use of nuclear bombs. He said at one point to this young mistress, this Mimi, he said, I'd rather my kids be red than dead.
Wow.
See, he never could have said that in public. But it was the measure of how concerned he was not to fight that nuclear conflict.
But he did take, to the public at least, responsibility for the Bay of Pigs.
He did. He went, and it served him brilliantly. And his approval rating went up to, 79-80%. And he joked and he said, the worse I do, the higher my numbers go, you see. But it was a very shrewd maneuver. And also he talked about he had to get rid of Alan Dulles. He had to get rid of some of these folks at the CIA. But he couldn't do it at once because it would look like scapegoating. And especially him having said, I'm the responsible party, he couldn't then drop the dime on some of
these people fired or fire them.
Exactly. So he waits and takes a while and he pushes them out.
But do you think for Kennedy that was a turning point where all of a sudden, you know, you're a young president, a new president, you gather all these experts around you and they give you bad advice, they give you wrong advice. Yeah. I mean, they tell you things that are not true.
Well, you know, Marty, it went back to World War II. When he was in the Navy out in the Southwest Pacific, and he saw some of the snafus and screw-ups by the naval chiefs. So he already had a fund of skepticism about some of these folks. This was profoundly expanded, compounded by that Bay of Pigs operation. But also, he was put off by the fact that Mac Bundy, McGeorge Bundy, former dean of Harvard faculty, who he made a national security advisor. Bundy calls up the general of the Pentagon who's responsible for the nuclear war plant. He says, we want to see this. And the general says, we don't show that. Uh-huh. And Bundy said, you don't understand. I'm calling for the president, you see. So Kennedy then has a meeting with the Joint Chiefs, and they describe what the nuclear war plan would be, which included dropping 170 weapons on Moscow. Atomic bombs, nuclear bombs. They point out hundreds of millions of Russians, Eastern Europeans, Chinese would be killed in a nuclear war. As Kennedy walked out of the room, he turned to Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, and said, and we call ourselves the human race. See? Mm-hmm. He was so chagrined by that. So he doesn't trust them. He doesn't accept the idea that, and of course this came to a head in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Sure. But one senses then the loneliness that a president like that can have when dealing with people who have sort of Dr. Strangelove views of warfare in the world.
Oh, yeah. It's because who's going to be blamed later? John Kennedy started the nuclear war. John Kennedy fought the nuclear war. John Kennedy killed 170 million people or whatever it was. So he was intently mindful of that and also what it would have done to the world, you see. You know, after the the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who he had held at arm's length throughout the crisis, he calls them in. They wanted to invade. And, of course, he resisted. He won, tried diplomacy first, and, of course, it worked. Afterwards, when he meets with them, they said to him, Mr. President, you've been had. Khrushchev is hiding the missiles in caves. Well, they leaked this to the press. Khrushchev writes Kennedy a letter and says, I don't live in the caveman age. In essence, I'm no caveman, you see. But we need to make a plan, they tell Kennedy, you know, invade, bomb. Okay, they make contingency plans. The plan they made included the use of at least one nuclear weapon on Cuba. If they had dropped a 1 megaton nuclear bomb on Cuba, it would have turned the island into a pile of rubble, let alone what it would have done to the south coast of Florida. But they had this rationale that they could contain the collateral damage, you see. So Kennedy, he just saw them as a little strange, bizarre. But, you know, Marty, what you have to understand is that these guys, the generals, they came out of World War II. How did you win that war? You bombed Hitler, the Japanese, back to the Stone Age, you see. And when you're fighting an adversary like Hitler, the Japanese military, Stalin, the Soviets, you got to beat them to the punch. This was their attitude. We're responsible to win such a war. We have the advantage in these weapons. So in some ways you understand why they thought that way, but Kennedy was the responsible authority. And happily, he operated with brilliant restraint.
And that's our guest, Robert Dallek. He is a presidential historian, has written a number of books. In fact, two books about John F. Kennedy, and his new one is titled Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. We're talking about the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll be talking about the Vietnam War as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And I have to say, this is a very personal thing for me as a kid growing up during this time, and the duck and cover where we would hide under our desks in case of a nuclear war. But it does underscore just how tense it was, how close we came to a nuclear war, and how, especially as you write in this book, how people, perhaps excluding President Kennedy, were very willing to go to war with these very dangerous weapons.
Yeah, there was a clearly a war mentality at that, and people had come out of World War II. The devastation, they were horrified that it might happen again, but survival. You know, who is it? The Air Force General Thomas Power said, "What is all this concern about using weapons like this? You know, at the end of such a conflict, if there are two Americans left and only one Russian, we've won." See, so that was sort of the attitude.
But can we say that because of the Bay of Pigs disaster, that Kennedy learned something and perhaps was negotiating around his own advisors in order to deal with Khrushchev?
Yeah, without question. The Bay of Pigs was a landmark moment in that administration and made him profoundly leery of what these folks would be telling him, and put him on notice that he had to be very careful about how, and that was the lesson he had brought it. He brought into the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was the lesson he brought into dealing with Berlin, which was a flashpoint at that time. Dean Acheson, Harry Truman's former Secretary of State, Acheson was so much of a hawk, and Kennedy and he clashed, and Acheson saw him and his advisors with a certain contempt, that they were like a bunch of high school kids. He didn't. He saw them as too young, inexperienced, and unwise, you see. But Kennedy read him and reined him in.
So, I mean, from your perspective, you see Kennedy as while he, yes, hired these people to be his advisors, he also was reluctant to take their advice.
Yeah, he became skeptical. He valued Bob McNamara, I think, most of all, after Bobby, of the people in his cabinet. And that's because McNamara gave him very sound advice during the missile crisis. McNamara was one of the principal architects and supporters of the idea that you try diplomacy first and resisted the military pressure to use force.
Meanwhile, while all this is going, things are heating up in Vietnam. And, of course, there are theories about whether Kennedy would have gotten us into Vietnam the way Johnson did, whether he would have whether he would have stood on the sidelines or figured out how to get out or use diplomacy or whatever. What is your analysis of that?
Well, my analysis of it is that we'll never know exactly what Kennedy would have done. We'll never know. Right. And because he himself was unsure. But I think there was tremendous reluctance on his part to expand the war and turn it into strictly or principally an American enterprise. He didn't want to send in ground troops. Now, there was a lot of pressure on him, particularly from Walt Rostow, who later became Lyndon Johnson's national security advisor. And Rostow was a fierce hawk. He wanted to bomb Hanoi and Haiphong as early as 61, 62. He wanted to talk about sending in those ground troops. And there was a split in the administration between those who were pressing him to think about putting in ground forces. Now, the compromise Kennedy made was to increase the number of military advisors from roughly 600 to something like 16,700. Mm. So that was a substantial expansion. But he wanted to keep this as low-key as possible, and he ran into a lot of conflict with the press, and particularly with David Halberstam, who was the New York Times bureau chief in Saigon. And Kennedy kept saying, because what's so interesting, of course, is that Halberstam later became someone who you saw as a fierce critic of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
In fact,
Best and the Brightest is one of his books.
That's right. Yeah. But early on, he wrote a book about the morass, the way in which we were not winning in Vietnam. And he was pressing for the idea that we needed to win. We shouldn't lose in Vietnam. So Kennedy was very skeptical of him, and he tried to get him out of Vietnam, asking the publisher of the New York Times to remove him. But the publisher wouldn't do it, to his credit, you see. But there was a lot of pressure on Kennedy to escalate that conflict. Now, I don't think – we'll never know, as I say, what he would have done. But I don't think he ever would have put in the massive numbers of ground forces that Johnson put in, 545,000. George Ball, the Undersecretary of State, said to Kennedy at one point, "Mr. President, you put 200,000-300,000 American forces in there on the ground in those jungles. We'll never hear from them again." Mm. See? And Kennedy said to him, "George, you're crazy as hell." And I think, meaning, "I'm never going to do that. I won't do it." He didn't want to lose Vietnam. That would have been a terrible political blow to him. But we'll never know what he would have done.
We're, again, up on a second break here, but you described him sending two people to Vietnam to report back to him. Right. They come back with diametrically opposed opinions and views about what was going on in that country.
And he says to them, "Are you sure you were both in the same country?"
Right.
So, you know, but it gave him an opening in a sense, because it left him with the feeling he wasn't getting authoritative advice. He had to make the decision. And his judgment was, don't get deeply involved in this war. The Vietnamese have to do the fighting. Mm-hmm. And that's why, of course, they sign off on the coup d'etat against the Diem regime on November 1, 63. Diem is toppled, and of course he's assassinated. Kennedy is deeply chagrined, pained by his killing, but he wanted to get rid of him in the hopes that he could get a better government in there that would fight more effectively.
That's Robert Dalek, our guest today on Radio Times, a presidential historian, author of a new book called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, talking about Kennedy's advisors giving him both good and bad advice related to the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Vietnam War. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Nearly 66 million people in the U.S. are family caregivers to someone who is disabled, aged, or ill. Are you a caregiver? Inglis and the Christopher and Dana Ree Foundation present a conference specifically for caregivers of people with physical disabilities, featuring Dr. Dan Gottlieb and focusing on ways to help yourself as you help your loved ones, Saturday, November 16th. For information and registration, inglis.org. That's INGLIS.ORG. Inglis supports WHYY.
The HBO series Boardwalk Empire is introducing a lot of viewers to music of the 1920s. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with musician, arranger, and band leader Vince Giordano. He and his band, the Nighthawks, perform the music for the show. He's been obsessed with music of the 20s and 30s since he was a child. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When bad memory makes good science.
She is very close to 100% incapable of forming new memories. She meets you one day and you come back the next day, she'll have no idea who you are. She is living in a permanent present.
How an unusual brain injury has become a miracle for scientists trying to figure out how memory works. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with presidential historian Robert Dalek. He has written two books about John F. Kennedy, the first one, An Unfinished Life, and the new one called Camelot's Court. He also wrote a book called Nixon and Kissinger. He's written for a number of publications and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, getting a history lesson about this important period in history and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me just pick up on something you said about JM, who was assassinated by the United States. But did Kennedy feel betrayed? Did he feel that somehow he was not in the loop when that decision was made?
Well, he made a tape recording that we have showing that he had a lot of recrimination and second thoughts. Why did he sign off on this? Which he did.
Right.
Which he did. Nobody should deny that. But he thought, gosh, did I do the right thing? What will be the outcome here? Are we going to have more dissent, more division, more turmoil? Will it enhance the ability of the South Vietnamese government to fight this conflict against the communists? You know, he didn't want to lose the country. It would have been a terrible political blow to him. He remembered who lost China, the Republicans beating up on the Democrats for that, and so they would go after him. He lost Vietnam. He was weak. He was a failed president. But on the other hand, he could see failure coming from getting deeply involved in Vietnam. And of course, Johnson didn't see that. Johnson was misled.
But you do write about Johnson, and I'm quoting here, upon prodding from the White House, Johnson offered unqualified advice against a substantial U.S. military effort in South Vietnam's conflict.
Yeah, Johnson went out as vice president on a trip to Southeast Asia, visited Vietnam. He came back and he made the case that the White House wanted him to make against the idea of sending troops there. Johnson privately said, I was sent out there with a stacked deck, you see. He, in essence, was the good vice president. The president wants you to do this. You've got to do it. And that's the way he treated Hubert Humphrey when he became president. Hubert, you do what I tell you to do. You are my man in court, so to speak. So Johnson had a different view, but he was reflecting, I think, what the White House wanted from him.
And they did not have the most, what shall I say, collegial relationship?
No.
Seems like they tolerated each other.
Right. And, you know, and the president understood Johnson was a huge ego and a man who felt diminished by the fact that he had been the great force in the Senate. And Johnson hoped to turn the vice presidency into something it had never been before. Indeed, Johnson wrote a memo, which he passed to Kennedy, asking for enhanced powers. And Kennedy read it. He laughed. He threw it into a drawer. See, never to be heard from again. Because what Kennedy understood was he was the younger guy, much more in Johnson's shadow as a senator, and he could not afford to be seen as running a co-presidency with Lyndon Johnson. So he had to rein Johnson in. Part of the way they did it was they sent him on these trips. So he let him go around the world. He'll be the big shot there. He'll go into Vietnam. He'll go into Cambodia. He'll go into wherever. And he sends him to Berlin when the Berlin crisis takes place. And Johnson's very reluctant to go. He's afraid he's going to be caught in the middle of a crossfire, you see. But he sends him there. Get him out of the country. Just let him sort of do his thing abroad.
Do you think, though, Kennedy ignored domestic policy, that his real interest, I mean, clearly his focus, but that his real interest was the world stage?
Oh, without question. He said, you know, politics can unseat you, but foreign policy can kill you. And civil rights is most interesting here because he was very reluctant to put a civil rights bill before the Congress. He feared that if he did that, it would undermine the three other domestic initiatives he had, which was a big tax cut, federal aid to education, and Medicare, you see. And he thought that if he could hold off on civil rights till a second term, maybe he'd get these through the Congress. But he got nowhere with it. It was a failed strategy. And then when he had this crisis in Mississippi, James Meredith, the integration of the university, and he had the big crisis in Alabama, he felt compelled finally to do something about this because he said, you know, these folks in the South, they keep saying, stay out, we'll take care of it. He said they never will. And also he understood that the Soviets and the Chinese were beating up unmercifully on the United States as a racist society. He was struggling to win the hearts and minds, as he put it, of people in the developing world, the third world. And as long as people of color were being told America is a racist society in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, it was going to be a losing battle, he felt. And so he had to act on this, both for foreign policy reasons and for moral concerns. And that speech he gave in June of 63 about civil rights was one of the great speeches of his presidency.
He has been, though, criticized for being either late to civil rights or not having the kind of sensitivity to the suffering that people were experiencing in the South. Is that a fair criticism?
I think
we'll get to our callers.
I think it is a fair criticism. You know, Martin Luther King said Kennedy did not have the moral passion to fight for equal rights for Negroes. For this race of people that was being so abused in this society. And so Kennedy, but he finally sort of, you see, it was like Bobby Kennedy also. After the president's death, Bobby Kennedy grew into this more humane role, this sense of the vulnerability that life contains and in his own family, and that even a president of the United States can be brought down in this awful way. So they changed, they grew. And I'm convinced that if Kennedy had lived, he would have run against Barry Goldwater, won as big election or close to it as Lyndon Johnson did, would have had big majorities in the Congress. He would have passed his four major initiatives, including civil rights. And that would have then been a very significant record of domestic achievement.
And that's Robert Dalek, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, presidential historian, and again, author of a new book about the inside of the Kennedy administration. The book is called Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, and it's about how he was both served and not served well by some of his advisors. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. If you live through that period of history, we'd love to hear from you. Let me get Gary from, looks like Malvern, to join us. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I was one of those young fellows who loved Jack Kennedy and still do. I remember his inauguration on television, black and white, of course.
Sure.
And I remember, I remember how fearful we were before. We were afraid of, I mean, people don't, it's easy now not to realize just how serious the so-called Cold War was.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I can remember the hydrogen bomb being let off by the Soviets, and I thought, and I was so young, but everybody saw this, the Soviets were just winning one after another, and there was such a national sort of depression, and here comes this young guy, you know. And us young people, I mean, he's talking Peace Corps. He's talking going to the moon. So the vision of it. And then we got into the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I wanted one comment I want to make, and a second one too.
Well, you know what, Gary, do me a favor. Only just give us one comment, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Sure.
The comment I make is that when Jack Kennedy was shot, I remember that his popularity was going down pretty much. the rosy colored glasses were going off because he was having difficulty getting his legislation through Congress. Ironically enough, I think his assassination sort of created this Camelot. It almost made him a martyr. And ironically enough, the same person who did not get along with the Kennedys very well, he was almost a successful partner in getting through some of that legislation, like civil rights, and that's Lyndon Johnson.
Sure. Well, Gary, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, I mean, it's interesting to bring back that time period. And Gary's right, which is that was a time of great stress and worry and anxiety.
Oh, enormous stress. And you know, I still teach university students. They don't have a clue, you know. They don't. Do they worry about a nuclear war? But students back in the 50s and 60s, this was front and center. It was, and you know, remember that joke? You're in the classroom. A nuclear attack is coming. Move away from the windows. Go under your desk.
I remember very well.
Put your head between your legs and kiss your backside goodbye. I mean, it was sort of the joke that people made of it because. You're not going to survive a nuclear war. It'll destroy everything. So, yes, there was profound concern. And, you know, Gary, you're right. Kennedy became a martyr. If he had lived and had a second term, we never would have had this sort of Camelot view of him and this exaggerated romance with him as we now have. Because it's tabula rasa. You can write on the slate anything you want. He's frozen in our minds at the age of 46. Nobody can realize if he were alive, he'd be 96 years old now.
Is that right?
See, that's right. 50 years later, he'd be 96. But he's still like he's one of us. If he walked into this room now, you see, he would look like a modern man, someone who is, you know, part
of our... He would look like the Kennedy we think of.
That's right.
That we have fantasized. But do you... So he was in office for 1,000 days.
Yeah.
So was he a great president?
No,
from your perspective?
No, I wouldn't say he was a great president, Marty, but I would say he was a significant president because I think that the civil rights – see, the four initiatives he put before the Congress, and Gary's quite right. These should be known as Kennedy-Johnson bills, the big tax cut, Medicare, the federal aid to education, and the civil rights bill were all Kennedy initiatives, and they should be Kennedy-Johnson bills.
Right.
Also, the nuclear test ban treaty, which ended the pollution in the radiation pollution in the atmosphere, was a big achievement. I think if Kennedy had lived, we would have had detente with the Soviets sooner than we did with Richard Nixon. So he was a significant president, and he did create a greater sense of hope for the country. And, of course, Gary mentioned man on the moon.
Sure.
You know, it happened. This vision put a man on the moon, and it happened by the end of the decade. So, yeah, there were significant achievements that should be remembered.
Let me see what Carol from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. And, Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had a quick question. How do you think, while I was listening to the conversation, I kept thinking of comparisons to the current administration. And how do you think that the administration compares? There was a lot of expectation and hope. There was a lot of frustration going on. And how do you think they compare and what can the current administration learn from the Kennedy administration?
Yeah, Carol, I appreciate the call. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. And what I should tell Carol and everybody else is, of course, I'm one of 8 or 9 presidential historians who's had dinner 4 times with President Obama. And he's mindful of history. He likes to talk to presidential historians. And, you know, also what we should mention is Kennedy, being the first Catholic, broke the hold of white Protestant males on the office. Could Obama ever have become president without Kennedy's achievement? And I think that is something that Obama is very mindful of. Now, when Obama was elected, there really was a parallel to Kennedy. Kennedy saying the torch has been passed to another generation. And there was the sense the same thing was happening with Obama. Of course, this is very different. An African American is going to the White House. What a phenomenal change in America. There was, I think, though, exaggerated expectations of what he could achieve. You know, there's been talk about the fact that people think presidents are miracle workers. And, of course, they stay there for a while. And, of course, it shows their vulnerabilities, their limitations. There's what's called the second-term curse. You know, all your vulnerabilities, so to speak, and the limitations. And he's been in a very difficult time with the fact that he doesn't control the Congress, the House of Representatives. He's profoundly frustrated, I think, by this situation. So, I mean, the difference with Kennedy is that Obama continues to be there. And if Kennedy had remained in office, I think he would have run into similar frustrations, too.
It's also interesting, and Carol, thanks for the call, to think about how Obama is being served or misserved by his advisors, by the people that he has brought in to give him sage advice.
Yes, and I think Obama has been, you know, skeptical too, and he's changed chiefs of staff quite a bit, hasn't he? So there are some parallels.
Are you done with Kennedy?
Yes, you know, somebody once said you write a book to forget a subject, and I thought that was the case in 2003 after I published my first book, but Kennedy kept coming back and coming back, and so I did this next book, but
you're
this
done.
Is it. I'm done. No more.
Well, Robert Dalek, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called Camelot's Court, and it's subtitled Inside the Kennedy White House. And again, Robert Dalek, the author of several other books, including An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, also wrote a book called Nixon and Kissinger, among other books. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. Jessica Crocker, the intern for Radio Times today. Our engineer is Adam Stanishevsky. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.